A man in search of new life comes to America. 10 years later, in a fit of rage, throws gasoline on partygoers in the Bronx and lights a nightclub on fire, killing 87 people. Who was this crazed maniac, and what brought him to such rage that he took the lives of 87 innocent souls? Today, the story of Julio Gonzalez and the Happy Land Fire on the dark side of Wikipedia.
Sometimes the human mind goes to dark places. Sometimes those dark delusions turn into reality. A reality so shaded and gray, once all is said and done, the healthy mind is drawn into the documented retelling of these tragic events, trying to find logic, reason, and understanding where there may be none at all. This is the dark side of Wikipedia.
Julio Gonzalez, a young man, just 26 years old. Most of his time was spent following others. He had been that way as far back as he could remember. When the guards kicked the prisoners out of their stinking cells that morning, he simply followed behind the people in front of him. But he hadn't committed any real crime on this occasion, that is. He simply told the police that he was a drug dealer so he could join the boat lift to leave Cuba. The guards marched him quickly through a forest towards a bay. A rolling surf pounded against the beaches with a familiar rhythm as they gathered at the edge of the sea to wait. They huddled into a dilapidated wooden dock that seemed to barely hold the crushing weight of hundreds of people. They stood in rows of threes as Castro's troops, their AK-47s held at the ready, hurried them along. "Vamanos, vamanos," the soldiers yelled as they pushed the helpless men and women towards the swaying boat at the end of the dock. The crowd moved quickly, and they knew the soldiers would shoot them down like dogs at the first provocation. "Vamanos," he screamed as they beat the prisoners with long, flexible sticks held in one hand and drank cerveza with the other. Of course, these people didn't know they were going and didn't really care. Anything was better than a Cuban prison where there was no food, little water, and lots of issues. Some said they were headed for America, though none could really comprehend this. What government would be crazy enough to take in another country's criminals? Somewhere along this multitude, a young man who was wearing rags and hadn't eaten in 2 days glanced around him. He had dressed or deserted the Cuban army in the early 70s and spent 3 years in prison. He recognized some of these men since he had been in jail with them since 1974. They were thieves, drug addicts, mentally deranged, rapists, murderers, and worse. They were political prisoners too, for Castro's jail made no distinction between them and other common criminals. These people were the national flotsam of Cuba, the corrupted and depraved, the rejected and the homeless. They joined 100,000 other refugees who would soon risk life and limb to reach the shores of a magical country they could easily die to see. They were a small part of a larger group, a footnote to history. And although these prisoners represented less than 4% of the immigrants who arrived in America during this tumultuous period, this era would mostly be remembered as the time Fidel Castro emptied his jails and dumped Cuba's unwanted into Carter's lap. This ragtag exodus became known as the Freedom Flotilla, and these people were later called Los Mariletos. The crowd shuffled along the dock like so much cattle, until they were tossed on a boat deck by two powerfully built soldiers who alternately cursed and beat the prisoners between gulps of warm beer. The tropical heat was brutal. Several women fainted and were lying on the deck unattended as the frightened mass simply stepped over the bodies, eager to escape the swinging whips of the guards. The boat trembled as the shifting weight caused it to tilt dangerously to port. When it finally got underway, its ancient engine kicking and gasping for air, the boat seemed as if it would barely make it out of the Mirror Bay. But out to sea it went, northeast across the Azure Sea, on its perilous journey to the fabled country that for them existed only in their dreams. For most of these refugees, however, that dream would soon become a nightmare when they later found themselves languished for months and years in detention centers in Arkansas and Wisconsin, the pawns of bureaucratic red tape and the ever-shifting political winds. Barely 2 weeks later, on May 31st, 1980, in Key West, Florida, Julio Gonzalez, 25 years old, uneducated, impoverished, a military deserter in his own country, a man who so far had accomplished nothing in life, an ex-convict with no possessions and no future, arrived in America. It is the dark side of Wikipedia. And this is a story that I was really shocked to initially hear about for how horrible this thing ends up. And obviously we'll get to just how horrible it ends up. But just that I remember many horrible stories and learned about them even before the time I was born. This one I'd never, ever heard of. And with that many people dying in a horrific nightclub fire that was intentionally lit, I was just kind of shocked to hear this one. So I thought, well, this would be an interesting one to share with our audience on the dark side of Wikipedia. I'm Tony Bruschi, Sean with us today. Did you have any knowledge of this story at all or anything ever?
You know, I remember the one in France, I believe it was, like 5 years ago. Sure. But prior to that, I had not. I want to say there was something. It wasn't a criminal act. I think it was just a fire. Yeah. I want to say out in Northern California as well, or the Oakland area, as far as a mass casualty. But this, no. And what we think of this gentleman, definitely the... All too often we talk about what ingredients were in the initial recipe growing up from an early childhood. And this gentleman, I don't anticipate him growing up to be a doctor of what we know of him thus far.
Yeah, I mean,
a social worker.
No, I mean, you look at this, I mean, you feel bad for individuals who have had such a horrible upbringing in life and all that. But at the same point, it's like the odds there, the recipes for disaster there, go up tremendously when that's the ingredients that you're given. And several, you know, break out of that and they don't go down that path. They don't go down that road. So you can't sit and, you know, judge anyone before it happens, but you want to be aware. And I guess most importantly, it ultimately goes back to the world of mental health and having availability for people to try and rescue themselves or others to try and help them. Not go down a horrible path when they've been given absolute shit ingredients. Essentially, like kind of the antidote to, you know, the poison that they've been drinking their whole lives. And obviously, in some cases, like we're reading about today, the antidote's never given. And what's the answer to that? You know, how does that work? It's not an easy solution by any means. Just speaking in very general terms, you know, that's where, if that was more readily available, I think you'd have less of those sort of issues that go on.
We all need that release.
Yeah.
People form it in exercise, some people in creating, some people in obviously 2020, all musicians who the amazement you feel when you go out on the road, you perform in front of thousands of people. Clearly it's been a rough year for so many, but just the human brain and us being as a whole to get to that feeling of that emotion. Some people go the route of murder to get what others get after they go for a 5 or 6 mile run, or those that redecorate their house or even make their bed or do laundry. Everybody has that thing. And as unique as we are, all of us throughout the world, some of us enjoy killing to have the same feeling that I would get of folding my clothes after I take them out of the dryer.
Yeah. I mean, I think it comes down to feeling. I think some people have been so damaged and been dealt such a shit hand that they naturally make bad decisions because that's all they know. And then they're just so numb to feeling anything, period. Good, bad, indifferent, happy, sad, whatever it may be. They're just numb to all of it, that it takes such extreme behavior for them to feel. That's where you get, you know, people with self-harm because they just want to feel something. And some people take it beyond self-harm and they start harming others to feel something. And what feeling you get when you take your clothes out of your dryer, oh, great, dried clothes, just the small little lift. They're never getting that little lift. So the first time they get a taste of that little lift, but it was done by doing something horrible or heinous or harmful, and they discover that's the only way I get that feeling. I don't get it from the clothes out of the dryer. I don't get it from taking a run. I don't get it from whatever productive, positive activity they could get. And then they seek that out and they search that out. And then you get situations like this. Let's continue into the Julio Gonzalez and the Happy Land Fire story here on the Dark Side of Wikipedia. And while you're listening, if you've not done so already, be sure to press subscribe wherever you are downloading podcasts so you don't miss any of our episodes. We have new episodes every single Monday and Tuesday. Best of on Wednesdays. And extras as well through Patreon. You can find more on that at darksideofwiki.com. Eventually, Julio Gonzalez made his way to New York City, where a large number of Los Marilitos seemed to gather. Through his sponsor, the American Council for Nationalities, he assimilated into the American society without incident. Later, he managed to secure a series of low-paying jobs, which gave him barely enough money to live on in one of the most expensive cities in America. He met a woman in 1984, Lydia Feliciano, who worked in a social club named Happy Land in East Tremont section of the Bronx. Soon he moved into her apartment and for the next few years drifted along in anonymity, making new friends, barely surviving a living and living a life even with infinitely better than a life in Cuba. The area of East Tremont Avenue near Southern Boulevard in the Bronx is an area that has undergone a vast amount of ethnic, social, and economic change after the Second World War. Then a neighborhood of primarily Italian and Irish immigrants, it evolved into an African-American community during the late 1950s and 60s. During the 70s and 80s, the area became a vibrant business enclave for the Hispanic immigrants from Puerto Rico, Honduras, Ecuador, and Mexico. Each ethnic group maintained its own culture, traditions, and heritage in the form of social clubs along East Tremont Avenue, Southern Boulevard, and the surrounding neighborhoods. No one really knew how many existed since most of these clubs operated in violation of city ordinances that were designed to prevent such clubs to conduct business in an unsafe and illegal manner. Social clubs are usually located back from the street front locations, away from the prying eyes of police and inspectors who had the authority to shut these places down upon discovery. But on the weekend nights, these clubs would rock with the sounds of Morange, Carlos Santana, all variations of Latino music, and especially the legendary Tito Punet, a Bronx icon. Such a club was Happy Land. The club was unique from the other bars in the Tremont neighborhood since it became the central meeting place for the Honduran community in the Bronx. These immigrants from Central America's poorest country also tended to be from the same region of Honduras, the northern border near Nicaragua. They came to America for the same reasons all other immigrants come, to seek a better life, escape grinding poverty, and chase the mythic American dream. Happy Land catered to the Hondurans by supplying customers with the homeland beer and sponsoring a social or soccer team for neighborhood youth. Unlike the Puerto Ricans, who have a much larger presence in New York City, Hondurans maintained a more fragmented community than other ethnic groups. Illegal social clubs pulled them together and provided a center for all types of social activities. Located at 1959 Southern Boulevard, just off East Tremont Avenue, Happy Land was a major attraction for the Honduran and Dominican communities in East Tremont. It was a place where immigrants could go to catch a glimpse of the old country, interact, and be with fellow countrymen and women. Happy Land also sponsored a Little League baseball team. Baseball is a very popular sport in Central America and especially in the Dominican Republic. Chicago Cub Sammy Sosa, a Dominican native, is considered almost a god in his country. The club hosted many parties for the league players, and on weekends, Happy Land was packed wall-to-wall with patrons who almost all knew each other by sight. "It's a connection to our culture," one customer told the newspapers. Time magazine reported on April 9, 1990, that over 1,000 such clubs existed in New York City. And March 25, 1990 was the weekend of Punta Carnival, which is the Honduran equivalent of Mardi Gras. Upstairs in the Happy Land Bar, about 2:30 a.m. this early Sunday morning, Julio Gonzalez, the Cuban army deserter and ex-convict, was sitting with ex-girlfriend Lydia Feliciano, 45. Julio recently lost his job as a warehouseman at a lamp factory in Queens. He was having a hard time paying his rent and was reduced to hustling on the streets of the South Bronx. At the bar, he drank beer and argued with Lydia, who had been living with him on and off for 6 years. There were also words about Lydia's employment at the club. Julio wanted her to quit, and she refused. Lydia didn't want much to do with Gonzalez anymore and refused to take him back. She told him that she had lots of potential boyfriends. Her family had already pressured her to end the relationship, but Julio persisted until Lydia finally tried to leave him at the bar. He grabbed her, and a bouncer intervened. Somewhere around 3 a.m., when the bouncer intervened, Julio became angrier. "She's my woman, not yours," he screamed. His fingers pointing at the bouncer, his hands waving towards the ground. The bouncer escorted Julio out of Happy Land, but he continued to argue in front of the club on Southern Boulevard while other patrons watched in amusement. He screamed, "I'll be back. I'll shut this place down," Julio screamed as he walked off into the night. Assuming he went home, the bouncer returned to the party on the second floor. The container used by Gonzalez to start the Happy Land fire. Julio was enraged. He had no job, no money, no prospects, and the only stabilizing influence in his life, Lydia Feliciano, had just dumped him. He walked over to East Tremont and Cortana Parkway, where the idea of burning Happy Land first came to him. He walked 3 blocks away to an Amoco gas station at 174th Street and Southern Boulevard. On the way, he found an empty 1-gallon Black Hawk hydraulic jack oil container. Inside the gas station, Edward Porras, 23, a Lehman College freshman, was working his first day on the job. He tried to buy gas, but Porras refused at first. Julio told him that his car broke down. Another man who was hanging around the station told the attendant that he knew Julio and that he was all right. Julio gave Porras $1 and filled the container. Later, when Porras found out he was the one who sold Gonzalez the gas, he said, "I don't know why this happened to me." So at about 3:30 a.m., Julio approached East Tremont Avenue carrying his $1 worth of gasoline. He walked the 50 feet from the corner to the street-level entrance to Happy Land. There was no one standing in the doorway at that time. All the customers who were usually found out front were upstairs drinking and dancing to the DJ music. The building itself seemed to rock from the pulsating music. Gonzalez, full of beer and anger, his sense of machismo deeply wounded, spilled gasoline onto the floor and the steps of the hallway. Several patrons who were at the top of the steps saw him in the shadows below but thought nothing of it. When he finished dumping the gas, he stepped back. Gonzalez lit 2 matches and threw them onto the floor. Immediately, the gas ignited. Volatility is highest when gasoline is first exposed to air. Even just a small amount will burst into what seems like an explosion if conditions are right. The fire quickly flamed up but remained confined inside the hallway area between the 2 doors. The one that led to the street and the inside door that led upstairs. Gonzalez walked across the street and watched. Inside Happy Land, Lydia Feliciano, seeing the flames behind the front door, began to scream fuego from the coat check area. Roberto Argueta, 23, who was at Happy Land since midnight, was picking up his coat and preparing to leave with Orban Nuez Galea when he heard the yelling. He and his friends saw the flames fully engulf the entranceway. They thought they had no way out, but Lydia led them to a little-used door on the north side of the club. When the terrified group reached the exit, they found that the outside metal gate was in the down position, preventing them from opening the door. Frantically, one of the men managed to reach between the door and the gate and with great effort raised the metal barrier up enough to open the door. They ran out onto the Southern Boulevard, not realizing at the time how truly lucky they were. On the second floor, the music was blasting. Most in the crowd were unaware of what was happening. They had no way of knowing. They had just minutes to live. The fire burned ferociously within the enclosed hallway as the inside door began to glow red from the heat. The DJ, Ruben Valadares, saw what was happening and tried to warn the crowd. He could see the fire down below him from the second floor landing. He stopped the music, raised the house lights, and screamed to the crowd. Some people began to take notice and tried to exit. They crowded around the stairway to go down, but were turned back by the smoke and the heat. The situation was becoming desperate. But Ruben decided to take his chances. He bounded down the steps, bypassing the partygoers, crawling between their legs, and crashed through the inside door, tumbling into the street below. He lay on the sidewalk, smoldering. His clothes burned off. He was badly injured, but he survived. Now that the door was opened, oxygen poured into the fire and powerful drafts were created. The effect was very similar to a chimney. The fire exploded to life and charged up the wooden steps and into the room. The people on the top of the steps screamed fuego and fled in terror. Fuego, fuego, they screamed. Within seconds, a huge cloud of toxic black smoke filled the staircase. As the blaze began to feed upon itself, the heat increased dramatically. The realization of a fire then became immediate to everyone. Soon the crowd was on the dance floor in the full panic as the black smoke poured unobstructed into the room. There were no windows in the 60 by 20 foot club. People instinctively fell to the floor face down where at least they could breathe, if only for seconds. For some, it was already too late. Those sitting at the tables had already inhaled the poison gases and a few breaths of such mixture is all it takes. Smoke from this type of fire is loaded with carbon monoxide, cyanide, and other gases emitted from burning wood and plastics. Blood cells absorb carbon monoxide readily, even faster than oxygen, causing immediate unconsciousness and imminent death. This is why statistically most people in a fire die from smoke inhalation rather than burn injuries. In Happy Land, there was no ventilation on the second floor, which contributed to the high concentration of airborne poisons. What little air existed in the club was replaced by thick arsenic smoke containing a lethal combination of burning gases. It's frightening to see the speed at which this type of fire can travel. Death can come very, very fast. Dr. Hirta of the medical examiner's office later said, if you consider together carbon monoxide poisoning, oxygen deprivation, and the effects of toxic substances in the smoke, death could in some cases be almost immediate, within a matter of seconds. Some patrons were later found sitting at their tables still clutching their drinks. Those closest to the stairwell died first, where 19 bodies were later found in a pile. Some had severe burns, but all died from smoke inhalation. The fire roared like an express train out of control. People were screaming and fighting each other to get to the stairway. But the way out was fully engulfed by flames. In less than 3 minutes, the second floor was filled with dense, compacted smoke and lethal gases, which were concentrated to extremely high levels. By the dozens, the partygoers fell into unconsciousness, stumbling onto chairs, tables, and each other. The fire continued to burn unmercifully, sending superheated gases into the room, filling every nook, cranny, every corner, every square inch of space with poison smoke until the crying, the panic, and the suffering stopped. Then there was only silence. Silence, but for the persistent sounds of reggae and Honduran calypso still playing in the background. A faint reminder of the brutality of life and the indiscriminate cruelty of death. In less time than it takes to read information on this story, 87 people, along with their dreams, their hopes, and a lost future that would never happen, lay dead on the floor under a sign that read, Happy Land. So, yeah, very dark scene. And the irony of it saying Happy Land is all but impossible to notice. Thoughts?
This sounds like a great script for a action drama. What do they call them? A rom-com? Romantic?
A Lifetime original.
Man, that is a knockout fight of emotions right there. My goodness, gets dumped. Goes to, how bad do you feel if you're the gas station employee who sells him the gas?
I mean, yeah.
You can't really, but...
No.
Whew.
Yeah, I mean, that individual, obviously, that's not their fault, but it's... You would still have a tremendous sense of guilt, you know, after, you know, going through that. I should note that today's entry is an excerpt from River of Tears, Happy Land by Mark Gatto. The Wikipedia entry on the story, surprisingly not very long, but I found this entry actually through Murderpedia, and that's where we're getting our source material from today to discuss. But my God, this is just horrific. I don't know where this goes. I don't know what happens to Julio. I'm very curious as to what happens to him after such a horrific, you know, I don't want to say outburst because it's just far more than an outburst. Horrific action taken. It makes you wonder, did he, and it's not an excuse by any stretch of the imagination, was his intention to kill everyone in the club? Was he mentally capable of connecting those dots that you set the entryway to the club on fire? You're going to kill everyone. Or did he just think he's going to start a fire and scare everybody? Either way, it doesn't matter. He killed everybody.
You get dumped. You're having a bad life. Hey, I'll show you. And then you start the fire and you're like, oh, shit. Oh, wait a minute. There's only one stairwell in this place and I just lit it on fire. And the whole thing's like essentially a really, really large casket. There's no windows. And oh, boy.
I mean, that's what you have to wonder a little bit is did he have the mental capacity to realize that the cause and effect of his actions? Not an excuse, again, but just more so trying to understand a human being who would do something like this. Was he capable of understanding cause and effect of those actions to the extent of what the effect actually was? There's no forgiving this. It's just trying to simply wrap your mind around what was this person capable of taking in mentally when he did this sort of thing.
Hey, relationships and the emotions you feel combined with your professional self-worth, if you hold what you do for a living, your functionality is as high in your life, if those two things are not firing on all cylinders, you can do anything.
Yeah.
I mean, you're kind of a loose cannon of sorts.
You are. Let's continue into the story and learn more about just how dark things got at Happyland. Outside the club on Southern Boulevard, pedestrians heard the muffled screams coming from the second floor. Ruben Valderez was withering in agony in the street, still smoldering from his leap to life, the only one to escape from the second floor. The fire department was already notified, received the alarm at 3:41 a.m., and within 3 minutes, fire apparatus from Ladder Company 58 arrived at the scene. When firefighters first drove on the block, they had no idea of the magnitude of the fire. It was very quiet inside Happyland. There were no screams. There was no sound at all. A firefighter later told the New York Post, as the firefighters applied water to the hallway on the steps, they saw several bodies. They entered into the darkness and began to pull out several victims. Soon the numbers multiplied. The rescuers found a total of 19 bodies. As bad as it was, they thought, at least it was over. Bronx firefighters are accustomed to the dead. Other firemen began to climb the steps and up to the second floor. As they entered the darkened room, the floor felt strange under their feet. They tripped over piles of clothes and unknown bundles, but slowly the horrible truth dawned on them. They were walking and crawling on bodies. Everywhere the firemen aimed their flashlights, they saw bodies piled upon bodies. What we saw was unlike the after-battle scene of any war movie, only this was real, said firefighter Craig Bracelli, Ladder Company 33, assigned to relief duty at the club. Once the fire was extinguished and the club ventilated for smoke, the reality began to emerge. As the smoke lifted, the magnitude of the tragedy was uncovered, so enormous it was hard to fathom, reported Deputy Chief Kenneth Carrera. The victims were dressed in party clothes or their Saturday night best. They lay on the floor, entwined with each other, some holding hands or gasping their throats. One man still held a fire extinguisher in his hands. Many had their arms outstretched as if to reach for the door. A scene so horrible, it shook the most hardened firefighter to the core. The worst, mumbled one fireman. The people seemed frozen in some grotesque parody. It had the sense of the surreal, like some Nazi gas chamber. Assistant Chief Frank Nastro was on the second floor of Happyland. The scene was paralyzing. We stood there, numbered. No one spoke. There were 69 bodies spread out amongst this 24 by 50 foot area. They all could have been sleeping. For the men of the New York City Fire Department who worked the fire, they would never forget the horrors of that night. Special units were sent out to all firehouses whose members worked the Happyland scene to help with the lingering emotional stress. Psychological counseling was made available to all rescue crews who were present. It's not easy to look at, pick up, touch, and feel 87 dead bodies. In their eyes, it was the hollow and distant look of men who could not believe what had occurred. As the true dimensions of the tragedy emerged, city officials flocked to the scene en masse. Mayor David Dinkins arrived quickly and surveyed the incredible carnage. First Deputy Mayor Norman Siegel said, "It was shocking. None of the bodies I saw showed signs of burns." Police Commissioner Lee Brown, Fire Commissioner Carlos Rivera, First Deputy Commissioner Ray Kelly, Chief of Detective Joseph Borelli, and a virtual army of reporters and photographers arrived at East Tremont and Southern Boulevard. Already the question of accountability was raised. It was common knowledge that Happy Land was one of the hundreds of illegal social clubs that existed in the city. An immediate inquiry into the city's role had begun. Even as the bodies of the victims lay on Southern Boulevard, clerks at City Hall were digging through official records, code violations, and inspection logs. The question of why Happy Land was allowed to exist had to be answered. It was the worst fire in New York City since the notorious Triangle Shirt Factory, which, by a strange coincidence, occurred March 25, 1911, exactly 79 years on the same day as Happy Land. And like the Bronx Blaze, nearly all the victims were young immigrants. At least 146 people died in that tragedy, which eventually inspired many reforms in the fire code and safety laws of New York City. It was soon discovered that Happy Land was ordered closed by the city for building code violations in November of 1988. The club was cited for no fire exits, alarms, or sprinkler system. Follow-up was supposed to be conducted by the fire department, but it was unknown exactly what had transpired. Politicians, as is their manner, promised investigations and revelations. But for 87 immigrants, it mattered little which bureaucrat failed in his responsibilities. The worst fire in New York City and one of the worst in American history was an explosion and fire in 1904 on board the excursion ship the General Slocum, which burned in the East River near Hell's Gate. Over 1,000 people lost their lives in this tragedy. After setting the blaze, Gonzalez stood in front of the club and watched it burn. Then, he calmly walked across the street and waited a few minutes as the fire began to take hold. Within seconds, the fire apparatus arrived and the firemen began to go to work. EMS arrived soon after, parking the ambulance just feet from where Gonzalez stood. He sipped his beer as the first body was carried out the front door of Happy Land. Then he walked a few yards over to East Tremont Avenue and boarded the number 40 bus westbound. On the bus ride home, Gonzalez began to cry, thinking about what he had done. He went directly to 31 Buchanan Place off Jerome Avenue to his apartment, which consisted of one cramped room. Yvonne Torres, another tenant, later told police she saw him arrive home at about 4:15 a.m. Gonzalez entered the lobby and soon knocked on the neighbor's door, Pedro Rivera. Carmen Melendez, Rivera's girlfriend, opened the door. Gonzalez told Carmen that he had trouble at Happy Land and started crying. He said he had killed Lydia and that he burned the club down. Carmen didn't believe him, and seeing that Gonzalez had been drinking, told him to go home and go to sleep. He went to his apartment, removed his gasoline-soaked clothes, and promptly fell asleep. At about the same time, Gonzalez collapsed upon his bed a few miles away at the 4-8 precinct. Detective Kevin Maroney, a senior investigator with over 20 years with the New York City Police Department, was told about a fire at a nearby social club. "I was doing a turnaround that night," he recently said, waiting for his next on-duty tour to begin. One of the other detectives came running into my office and yelled that 80 people were killed in a fire. My first reaction was, "What the hell is he talking about? I never heard of such a thing." "I didn't believe it at first," he said. Within minutes, it seemed, an onslaught of people descended upon the 4-8. Uninformed officers brought in potential witnesses and survivors, and the press began to assemble. Local district attorneys and assistants appeared. Fire department personnel, police department brass, politicians, and a platoon of detectives all came to the front desk of the 4-8 until the lobby was jammed with a mixture of frantic people all clamoring for immediate and urgent attention. It was pandemonium. Detective Morey never reached the front door of the precinct house. "I never made it to the street. Witnesses had to be interviewed, statements had to be taken. We did not know what happened. All we knew was that lots of people were dead," the detective recalled. Morey and his partner, Detective Andy Lugo, began to piece together a first draft of what happened at Happy Land, and slowly the story began to emerge. "We finally spoke to Lydia Feliciano later that day. She left the scene and never told anyone where she was. In fact, at the time, no one even knew that she was vital to the case. As soon as she said that she had a fight with her ex-boyfriend, and he left the club angry just before the fire, we had strong suspicions," Detective Monray said. At about 4 p.m. that same day, detectives Maroney and Lugo went over to 31 Buchanan Place and knocked on the door of Julio Gonzalez's third floor apartment. "Who's there?" Nay, a voice behind the door asked. "Police." "Sí," the voice replied. When Gonzalez opened it, the detectives were immediately overwhelmed by the odor of gasoline. They asked him to come over to the police station and talk about the fire. Gonzalez didn't seem too upset at the time. Maroney said that he wasn't surprised to find Julio sleeping. Cops are familiar with the curious sleep habits of criminals. They know that even after the most horrendous crimes imaginable, suspects will fall asleep. In the rear of a police car, at the station, during booking, in cuffs, anywhere at all. It doesn't matter how violent the crime, how shocking or brutal, a criminal will fall asleep if he didn't have a care in the world. Gonzalez put on his gasoline-soaked shoes and went with the detectives. Gonzalez was taken over to the 4-8, where he was read Miranda warnings in Spanish and agreed to talk about the incident. Detective Maroney said that he turned to get a cup of coffee, and before he could give it to Gonzalez, Julio immediately began to confess. "We practically didn't even have to ask him anything," he said. He told police that he set the fire for revenge against Lydia Feliciano. He said that he was angry that she broke up with him and wouldn't take him back. "I know, it looks like something bad got into me. It looks like the devil got into me," Gonzalez said in his confession. He was later arraigned in the Bronx criminal court at 2 a.m. on 87 counts of murder, the worst mass murder in American history up to that time. In a highly unusual move, Bronx District Attorney Robert Johnson handled the court appearance himself in front of Judge Alexander Hunter. Gonzalez was held without bail and taken to a local psychiatric ward, where he was held as a suicide risk. You know, I can't sleep when I am worried that the dryer is still running or something like that. Or there's something that's on my mind that really is not a big deal, but something that's still kind of out there and in the ether. I don't know how the fuck you're able to fall asleep after you just killed 87 people and lit a club on fire. Is it part of the psychological thing that's going on with someone that, number one, they were able to do that, that their body is just, you know, is it like a coping mechanism? The body just can't handle it, that it just shuts down?
I think it is. It's similar. I would agree. The numbness, you just do something to try to feel.
I don't know. I mean, the problem with things like this is we're rational people. We're not people who are capable of doing something like this, and we're trying to run it through our prism of thinking and our prism of reality, and no matter what way you do it, it doesn't make sense. And it looks utterly crazy, because it is utterly crazy. But that's where if you're interested in it and you want to try and dig deeper and try and just find an explanation that's deeper than just saying, well, they're fucking crazy. Because that's the only really way you can learn about behavior like this and hopefully find ways of preventing others from going down this path. You have to try and look at things through their prism. How are they viewing things? How is this making sense to them? Because to him... this was a sensible act. This is what, you know, A plus B equaled C in his mind when he did this. To the rest of the world, to reality, it doesn't. But to him, it did. And how does someone get there? That's, I think, the big question that you try and figure out in cases like this.
This is a gentleman that ultimately... what is very interesting is we all have bad days. It's just a matter of how unsettling some are. And even more that something needs to be done as a whole to make it that much easier to get the help you need.
Yeah.
And we always say that if an emergency happens, or there's a fire, or there's a car accident, when something that we all see, paramedics arrive, firefighters, police. But what's going on in between the ears and behind our eyes, all too often people don't truly understand. So it's so nonchalant when he said, oh, must have been in a bad mood. Maybe the devil got inside of me and can be so, like, he's talking about the weather. That's the eerie part.
Yeah, I mean, just to jump to something like that, oh, it was the devil, you know? It's like, no, it wasn't the devil. You're out of your fucking mind. You have a mental illness of some sort that made you think this was the appropriate response to your girlfriend breaking up with you. And it's just, it's horrifying to think of that. There is more to this story, and this is a new thing that we're doing here on the Dark Side of Wikipedia. It's called The Final Chapter. And if you're a Darksider, you'll get access to that, as long with access to advanced episodes of the show months before they're released to the public, our complete archive of episodes, all commercial free. And if you want to hear the final chapter of the Julio Gonzalez and the Happy Land fire story, then go to darksideofwiki.com. That's our website, and follow the links to become a Darksider, and you'll get access to all of that in the final chapter of this story. Darksideofwiki.com. Click Become a Darksider, and you will get access to our final chapter on this dark story and the conclusion of Julio Gonzalez and the Happy Land fire. Check it out, darksideofwiki.com, or search Dark Side of Wikipedia on Patreon. We'll see you on the other side of the final chapter of the Dark Side of Wikipedia.